The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
It's from Master Dongshan's Song of the Jewel Mirror Samadhi, Part 2. The Dharma of thusness is intimately conveyed by Buddhas and ancestors. Now you have it. Keep it well. Fill in a silver bowl with snow, hiding a heron in the moonlight. When you array them, they're not the same. When you mix them, you know where they are. The meaning is not in the words, yet it responds to the inquiring impulse. If you're excited, it becomes a pitfall. If you miss it, you fall into retrospective hesitation. Turning away and touching are both wrong, for it is like a massive fire, useful but dangerous. If it is only expressed in language, this precious mirror will be stained. So a couple of weeks ago, I started this and just spent time on the title of the poem in the first two lines. And I wanted to say a little bit more about the mirror. It's a metaphor and an image that is used a lot in Buddhism to reflect the mind, to speak of the nature of awareness. Longchenpa said, this awareness is like a limpid looking glass. It's a basis for the horizon of all reflected forms, which in the moment when such forms appear, do not exist in the mirror as any one of them. The surface of the glass is neither white nor black, yet it provides the base in which both white and black appear. Awareness, too, is like this. In knowing this, you will be skilled in wisdom. So the mirror perfectly reflects whatever comes before it. But whether what comes before it is small or large, the mirror doesn't become small or large. The object does not become part of the mirror. It's not the mirror itself. When it appears in front of the mirror, nothing is added. When it leaves, nothing is lost. And it responds effortlessly. The mirror doesn't work to reflect. It's its nature. What is reflected in the mirror is not the mirror. What is reflected in the mind is not you or me. So if we think of all the different things that appear before the mind, before this mirror, bright and clear, people, objects, situations, the earth. And within our misunderstanding, it's as though these things appear and then the mirror tries to take them in, absorb them into the mirror, to become the mirror, and make a home for them. And therein they reside in the mirror as something. And to think also about how we appear before each other's mirrors, minds, and how this is going on everywhere. And that each mirror reflects back, in one sense perfectly, because that's the nature of the mirror, but all too often, the mirrors reflect back dustily, because it's as though they're not clear, as though there's something on the surface of the mirror that changes things. And that dust in this metaphor affects the image, seems to change the images that appear before the image. Change it as the mirror tries to absorb those images inside. And so there's a kind of co obscuring. The Buddha's taught this most profound teaching of codependent arising, and that when, with our attachments and false views, that codependency is a kind of co-obscuring. We delude each other. And so Dongshan says, intimately conveyed by Buddhas and ancestors, this dharma of thusness. Now you have it, keep it well. So how do we realize this mirror, jewel mirror of samadhi? And so remembering the story of the sixth ancestor, the poem by the head monastic, the body is a Bodhi tree, the mind is like a standing mirror. Always try to keep it clean. Don't let it gather dust. And so this is what so much of practice is. And yet Kazan says in one of his poems in the Transmission of Light, everyone wants to keep the mirror clear and clean, but sweep as we will, we can never sweep away all the dust. And he's not speaking about insufficiency of practice. He's talking about the nature of the mirror and dust. And yet, we try to keep it clean and not let it gather dust. And so then Huainong comes along and presents the more fundamental. There is no Bodhi tree nor stand upon which the mirror stands. Since everything is empty, where could dust possibly alight? Intimately conveyed by Buddha's ancestors, now you have it, keep it well. This is the essence of Buddha Dharma. This is the ultimate path. Buddhism is a word that describes many different things to many different people, different forms of practice. Even in the Buddha's time, the Buddha taught different things to different people. Certain students who might have had a very strong sort of linear mind, the Buddha might have taught in a certain way. Other students who had a more intuitive, directly encountering mind, the Buddha taught in a different way. And so for some people, Buddhism might be more of a devotional practice. For some people, it might be just singularly zazen. Other practitioners may not meditate at all. But from within the teachings, if we listen to the teachings that have come down to the practice traditions, certainly our own, this dharma of thusness that is to be intimately conveyed is our path. Now you have it. Keep it well. Master Sheng Yen, in commenting on this, says, these two lines are advice from the master to the disciple. A glimpse of the precious mirror is not yet Buddhahood. A disciple might have an experience of enlightenment, but it's not ultimate enlightenment. Enlightenment disappears when vexations arise. Therefore, when the teacher acknowledges the disciple's understanding, they also give a warning. There is a gain and a loss with this insight. What the disciple has gained is the understanding or the vision of this precious mirror, encountering it directly. The teacher has affirmed a level of understanding. However, if this understanding is not protected through diligent practice, it will be lost again. This is often called sudden enlightenment, gradual cultivation. That there are moments of insight, of understanding, of shift, and then there is continued and ongoing practice, which he speaks of as cultivation, cultivating that insight. But Master Sheng Yen says enlightenment disappears when vexations arise. Where does it go? What cannot be gained can never be lost. And enlightenment is never gained. And so, all of the ways of speaking about it. That's why these metaphors, these examples are so prolific within Buddhism. And they probably exist in every spiritual tradition, teaching stories, because everyone loves a good story. And stories have a very powerful way of conveying a message through the story that can bring it alive. But particularly within Buddhism, where that which is being conveyed ultimately cannot be given and conveyed in language, these examples are to try and bring forth that sense of what is to be intimately conveyed, directly experienced, so that the practitioner is enlivened by that, is guided by that. And so all of these ways of speaking about this mirror is not about the mirror. It's not to get caught up in this example. It's to understand that as speaking about our own mind, and then how, using that example, then do we practice? So it always feeds back into how we are practicing. How to illuminate what appears hidden, how to understand the dust. Because it does seem as though dust on the mirror obscures the image. Right? That's an ordinary experience. So what is the nature of that dust and the nature of the mirror? And that's rather important, because as we encounter what we are calling dust in our meditation, in our practice, how we understand that becomes extremely important, because that's how we will practice it. And so when we begin to understand or have faith in things as having no intrinsic characteristic or quality or power or existence, that all things ultimately have one nature, how does that influence our practice? And so perhaps it's not so much that enlightenment is lost, having never been gained, but that our sense of it, our experience of it, becomes overwhelmed or overcome again by old habits, by beliefs that are still existing, still present, and still have strength. The slightest distinction separates heaven and earth, enlightenment and delusion. And just as those two poems about the mirror, they are both true and not true by themselves. They need each other. The slightest distinction separating heaven and earth is true and not true. And both are essential. And so Master Shengyan said, if this understanding is not protected through diligent practice, it will be lost again. And so everything that we do in practice, everything we're doing this week in Rahatsu, is a path and is the embodiment of that path. Right? We understand the path as being a way towards something, a way to suchness. It's harder to understand how that path in this moment, in every moment, is the embodiment, the fruition, the manifestation of that suchness itself. And so we can understand that as the mirror, bright, is always clear and perfectly reflecting, but the dust makes it hard to see. And even the idea of protecting is true and not true, can be problematic. Protected in the sense of diligence, in the sense of ongoing practice, in the sense of ceaselessness, but not protection in the sense of possessiveness or clinging or fear or anxiety of losing something. And so Dongshan says, keep it well. Now you have it, keep it well. Keep it alive. Keep it honest. Keep it integrated. keep giving it away. And so there is daily practice. There is intensive practice. Both of those are essential and work together. To cultivate, to develop, to nurture, to evolve. And there is seeing self-nature. Intimate contact with thusness, which is realizing it's always been here, always present, always complete. There was never anything missing. And so the poem continues, filling a silver bowl with snow, hiding a heron in the moonlight. When you array them, they're not the same. When you mix them, you know where they are. These two are images that are often used, along with others, that speak about how a silver bowl filled with snow, that if we just glance, because there are similar qualities, snow and a silver bowl, that they might seem to blend into one. But a more discerning eye recognizes that there are differences there. But without further discernment, there could be a confusion that they are fundamentally and existentially separate, that they have no common, no sameness, no same nature. An awakened eye sees the differences and sees the self-nature as being one and sees that both of those exist together at the same time. And even to say together is too distant. And that they abide within their particularity, in their particular forms, a silver bowl, snow, a white heron in the moonlight. So it may seem that the heron seems to disappear in one moment in the moonlight, and then suddenly we see it again. And that they abide within their particular forms, within their Dharma nature, in a state of non-abiding. That when we look for the heron, when we look for the snow, the silver bowl, the moonlight, we cannot locate it. When Master Dongshan was leaving his teacher, Yunyan, he asked him, if after many years someone should ask if I'm able to portray the master's likeness, his teacher's likeness, how should I respond? And I've read that in transmitting the Dharma that there were objects that were given. So we know of, in the beginning, Bodhidharma giving his robe as a symbol of having given the Dharma, transmitted the Dharma. But I read that during a period of time, there was also where the master would give a portrait of their likeness, which is a way of verifying that they had received the transmission. I don't know if that's what Dongshan's referring to here, perhaps. So he asked this question. If somebody asked me if I'm able to portray the master's likeness, how should I respond? Now, of course, Dongshan is not talking about a portrait, a painting, but rather the having met Yunyan. Who did he meet? And Yunyan remained quiet for a while and then said, just this one. And Dongshan kind of sank into a reverie, contemplating this. And Yunyan said, Acarya, having assumed the burden of this great matter, you must be very cautious. You must be very cautious. Having assumed the burden of this great matter. Realizing this great matter is to be liberation. Why does his teacher speak of it as a great burden? In a sense, the more we understand in any field, the more we are accountable within that field, the more we should reasonably expect of ourselves to be able to come forth from that place. And so Yunyan says, you must be very careful. And so it says, Dunkshan remained dubious about this, questioning. And later, as he was crossing a river, he saw his reflected image in the water and experienced a great awakening into this exchange between it with him and his teacher. And he composed a verse. Earnestly avoid seeking without, lest it recede far from you. Today I am walking alone, yet everywhere I meet this one. They are no other than myself, but I am not now them. It must be understood in this way in order to merge with suchness. Everywhere I meet this one, this self-nature, this person of no rank, they are nothing other than myself, but I am at the same time not them. It must be understood in this way. If we don't understand it that way, if we only understand it as I am not them, then we get trapped within that. And of course, that's the basic place of samsara. The Buddha said delusion is I am this, this is me, this is mine. But that at the same time is saying, I am not that. That is not me, that is not mine. And so the world is divided up into what is me and mine and what is not me and mine. And so then the differences that we perceive, and think about all the times that teachings talk about not being deceived by appearances. The appearances are the qualities, the characteristics that things have. Those are the things we notice. That's how we identify things. Those qualities and characteristics are the things that we like, that attract us, or that we don't like. And so when we're trapped in, I am not now you, I am not now them, then the differences, those characteristics, basically become the whole story. Because what else is there? The only story. And so then it makes sense that age or skin color or gender or beliefs or speech, clothing, the appearances, the way things appear, become the main actors in the play. And because though they become the feature, basically the whole story, they take on a kind of excessive, unskillful power and attention that is we give to them, which actually then makes it hard to appreciate the richness and the beauty of those very characteristics. So it's kind of interesting that when we become attached, which would seem to bring us closer, which would seem to heighten our appreciation of something through that attachment, that actually does just the opposite. It diminishes, it obscures, it makes it harder to actually appreciate and cherish and delight in those qualities. Because they have become too much, too important. They have become something that they're not, actually. And so what they are then becomes obscured. It's like we forgot the essential purpose of the story, which is to be at ease, connection, belonging, generosity, taking care of each other, loving life, to be free of suffering. And so it can seem curious or, depending on one's perspective, unfortunate or ironic, that this path to realize the great ease, the great peace, the great relaxation, the great liberation must be a path that must be so diligently walked, so effortfully practiced, that it needs to be so vigorous, and that it needs to include our pain and suffering, which is a good thing because we can't leave it behind. But it's necessary because it is there within all of the small and large woes that we have the opportunity to look directly into the mirror and to examine what we're calling dust and to understand the Buddha's original teaching about the cessation of suffering. And so when we get caught in too much of the thingness of things, that new story that we create and that we create together and is universal, it's just a human activity, actually distracts us, becomes a distraction from the real, essential thing. And that's why the wonder of bodhicitta is, what is it that happens? How do we come to those moments of waking up within the dream and having some deep faith, perhaps inexplicable faith, that there is another way? Dungshan says the meaning is not in the words. The meaning of this suchness is not in the words, yet it responds to the inquiring impulse. If you're too excited, it becomes a pitfall. If you miss it, you'll fall into retrospective hesitation. Turn away and touching are both wrong, for it is like a blazing fire, useful but dangerous. If it is only expressed in language, then this precious mirror will be stained. So we hear over and over and over again that the meaning, the true Dharma, cannot be conveyed in language, in words, in meaning, in ideas. As Longchenpa says, it is not anything at all. It is empty of any inherent existence. And yet, and because of this, it can appear as everything or anything. And so it responds to the inquiring impulse. Shengyen translates that as, yet those who are ripe must be taught. And so we are, in a very real sense, continually through our practice, learning how to respond with an inquiring impulse, from an inquiring impulse. Bodhicitta is that. It's an impulse forward, an impulse into inquiry, into examining, into wanting to understand. And that's why those two aspects of Zazen have to be present. One is the calming of the mind, developing samadhi, and the other, which is the calming and the stabilizing and the finding ease, which means not judging, right? Not struggling against ourselves, and that aspect of inquiry, of insight. Cleary translates that line as, it responds to emerging potential. So that as our, even though Buddha nature is completely present, as our potential to see that more and more clearly develops and strengthens, then our practice responds to that, right? In a sense, what appears before us responds to that as we become more able to see more clearly and respond skillfully. And so inquiry, reflection, the spiritual imperative, as Dada Roshi used to speak of it, brings forth this potential, ripens the fruit of our seeking mind. And that's also why Sesshin is so important, because it really helps us to bring that out. Right? And we see it's such a common experience that the more cluttered, the more busy, the more distracted, the more preoccupied we are, the more that deep yearning becomes obscured, becomes distant, it becomes more of a memory. It's like an aroma that we can almost smell but can't quite reach. But then when we practice, particularly during session, and a lot of that dust is wiped away, then that impulse can become very strong, right? And so it's very common towards, as the week progresses, towards the end of the week particularly, that there is a renewed sense of vigor, of vitality, of dedication. And so when we turn to the Dharma is present and responds. A while back, I was speaking to a student who's been a student for a long time and had gotten into a kind of a dark place in their life. And there was a moment of despair where they said that the words came, just popped into their mind, just sit. Just that. And they did. And they had not been. And so they went to that cushion and sat. And in that, and they said in the very first moments of sitting again after so long and being in such a deep, dark place, that there was something that was immediately there for them. And it wasn't that their mind was all clear and that everything was, but there was something that they were immediately able to touch. And I, in listening to them, I was thinking about how when we train deeply and over time, that training, that's what I said to them. As I said, you turn to your training. Your training called out to you, called you in, beckoned to you. If you're excited, it becomes a pitfall. If you miss it, you fall into retrospective hesitation. So we raise aspiration, we practice with vigor. The sutras, so much of what we do is continually trying to rouse that mind, that inquiring impulse, that mind that seeks, that has confidence, that has faith, which is also bringing us out of any state of dullness or complacency or indifference that we might slip into. But in rousing that, right, that needs to become stable and still and powerful. And that is our concentration. That's our samadhi. And so the Buddha said those two aspects we need to continually be aware of when they appear, of all the different ways the mind shifts into that dullness, which is just a form of aversion. It's a way of sort of negating, pushing away, whether it's actively pushing away or just quietly kind of becoming numb to. And on the other side, the clinging, the grasping. And that's really a very profound guide. Just that, just to be aware of those two aspects, those two inclinations, and then to become more and more familiar with all the ways those show up and the particular ways they show up for each of us because of our own karmic dispositions. In other words, the things that we tend to slip into easily. And those are particularly important because they have a lot of karmic strength, which means we will slip into them more frequently. There's identity, there's a sense of self in there, it's going to be more difficult. It's also going to be difficult to let go of because the fact that it becomes habitual means that we have invested trust and faith in that habit. Which to a non-practitioner may seem, you know, illogical. Why would we invest in and continue to return to, sometimes actively, consciously, even something that was causing us pain, that was binding us? Well, I would just invite them to sit for a few minutes and then they'll begin to understand. And that excitement, sometimes that's what also happens in session, is as the mind is calming, if there is concentration developing and energy and samadhi, sometimes that gets into a kind of an excitement, right? They can begin to disperse and scatter. And so we keep bringing it back in, dropping it back down so it becomes stable and useful. You know, bodhicitta is kind of like a parent who loves the child so much that no matter what the child does, their love is unbroken. And bodhicitta is like, it's like cultivating that hunger to accomplish ourselves within the Dharma and to understand more and more what does that mean. Because it's not like the old accomplishments. And to be able to do that and to keep bringing ourselves to that despite the difficulties and the challenges and the doubts and insecurities, and whether those difficulties seem to be coming from the outside. And so the few doksans I've had with some of you who are practicing at home have spoken about your well-laid plans to practice this week and then things appearing, or whether those challenges come from inside. That cultivating our bodhicitta, our faith, our perseverance, our determination is really that vow. That is the nature of the vow, to continue to keep coming back, whatever might appear. Not despite what arises, but with what arises. Putting whatever arises in service to the Dharma, in service to your own path. And that's where we have to encounter those moments to discover, how do we do that? How do we take something that seems clearly just to be blemishing the mirror, in the way, not a good thing, how do we, and whether that seems to be coming from the outside or seems to be coming from the inside, how do we put that into service of practice? And that's a completely legitimate question. And there were so many times in my training where I was not clear about that. I wanted to know. I wanted to do that. I wanted to put this into practice, but I wasn't entirely clear what that meant. But if we just bring forth mindfulness, if we reflect on those polarities of aversion and grasping, if we see this appearing as an aspect of mind, that's a good beginning. And then to continually meet those challenges in every step. Recently, I was listening to a string quartet by a quartet that I was unfamiliar with, called the Esme Quartet. They're a group of four young women, and they were very impressive. Really, I thought, amazing musicians in themselves. And clearly, each of them was a very, very accomplished musician in and of themselves, but also together as a quartet, they were exquisite. And in my humble estimation, not all quartets are like that. Because part of the whole magic of that form is that they are like, it's so intimately together that the music can be heard. And Jiman and I were watching them play this quartet, and I turned to Jiman and I said, I have an idea of how they spent their childhood. Because no one comes to that kind of accomplishment without a tremendous amount of application. Turning away and touching are both wrong, Dongshan says. For it's like a blazing fire. And then he adds, useful but dangerous. And turning away and touching are what we already know how to do. We clearly know how to turn away. We know how to touch. And so Hong Zhu, in his Lancet of Seated Meditation, said, wrote, the essential function of all Buddhas the functioning essence of all the ancestors. It knows without touching things. It illumines without facing objects. Knowing without touching things, its knowledge is inherently subtle. Illumining without facing objects, its illumination is inherently mysterious or ineffable. And this, the Lancet of Seated Meditation, he's talking about Zazen, how we meditate. And so when Dongshan says, turning away and touching are both wrong or unskillful, for it, the suchness that has been conveyed intimately is like a blazing fire. This mind is like a blazing fire. Our attachments are like a blazing fire. Useful, but dangerous. As all things that have power are. And so we have to learn how to wield those things that we have been given. This Dharma, these practices. So when we talk about bypassing, you know, using our ideas of practice and the teachings to essentially turn away or touch, get entangled, that's just another way of talking about using the power of the Dharma and practices in a way that is not helpful. And so in Zazen, we are discovering, by practicing, how to neither turn away nor touch, how to know without touching things, encounter without entangling, to illuminate without touching, to cultivate a very keen and vibrant disinterest, an intimate detachment, a very wakeful serenity. And because those might seem to be contradictory, we don't figure them out. We discover by, oftentimes, to a great degree, by falling into turning away, by falling into touching and entangling, and then realizing, oh, I've turned away. Realizing, oh, I'm entangled. So now, having turned away, how do I turn back? What does that actually mean? Now, realizing I'm entangled, how do I untie this knot? And this particular knot. And that is practice. That is wiping the mirror clean. And it is also based in every moment, even when we may be just completely aware of the thingness of things, that is arising out of, that we are sitting in or resting upon, there is no Bodhi tree. There is no stand upon which the mirror can be seen. And so when we look into a pond and the wind blows and it seems to break up the image, the surface of the pond itself, the wind, the ripples, they're all part of one whole integrated suchness. Clearly illuminated, Dongshan says, just as at the middle of the night, it does not appear in the morning light. It is a standard for all beings used to extricate them from all suffering. Although it takes no action, it is not without words. Like gazing into a jewel mirror, form and reflection see each other. You are not this true person, but this true person is clearly you. And so in Seishin, we cultivate, we might say, this middle of the night, this night when all of the senses, all of the activity, all of the sense of something and something else, of this and that, and all of the barriers and boundaries that arise together, all of those are calmed and relaxed and allowed to return to their natural place, peaceful. It is a standard for all beings used to extricate them from suffering. It is a universal. It is true for every being, every person, Buddhist or non-Buddhist. All Buddhas throughout space and time. And so ultimately we see that all of our seeking and our traveling and our inquiring and our struggles, all of our practices are necessarily unnecessary. Are unnecessarily necessary. The great yogi Talopa said to his student, Naropa, appearance does not fetter you. Things appearing in front of you are not what fetters you, not what binds you. It's your clinging to them that does. Therefore, free yourself of clinging, Naropa. Shantideva said it this way, it is not indeed our purpose to disprove experience of sight or sound or knowing. We're not trying to prove that that's wrong or somehow broken or shouldn't be. That is not our purpose. Our aim, Shantideva said, is here to undermine the cause of our suffering and sorrow. The thought that all of those phenomena have their own power, their own being, exist apart. That is our aim, is to undermine our belief, our faith, our experience, that that is so. And I think if we reflect on this from wherever we are in practice, then that can't help to inform and guide how we practice and build faith in practicing more and more skillfully, more peacefully, and with vibrancy. Opening your eyes, raising your hand, here, saints and demons, joy and grief, each and every rests perfectly in the palm of your hand. It must be so. And because of this, we have the great power of mind to free ourselves and each other.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.